here. Home run, Lenny Dykstra.
Stairs rips one into the night. Deep into right. Way out of here.
The Phillies win the game on a base hit by Mitch Williams at 4:40 in the morning.
Swing and a miss. Struck him out. It's wacky. Wonderful. Bunch of throwbacks has won the National League pennant.
Welcome to this week's episode of Continued Success, a Phillies podcast where we talk about, that's right, the Phillies. But also we make a point to go back in time and chronicle the 2009 Philly season as well as we did last season with the 2008 and 1993 teams. I'm Justin Clue, the head guy at The Good Fight, and with me is Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports. Liz.
I don't think the Phillies are playing tonight. I haven't heard anything. No word.
I got to tell you, it's weird that they've played two-game series against the Nationals. And
I know, it's weird. There's nothing happening.
Yeah, there's just nothing going on.
The games we played in the Vortex.
Yeah.
No one knows.
I mean, there's a new picture of Aaron Judge standing next to Jose Altuve that's circulating. So I guess that's the biggest baseball news of the night. But other than that, nothing Phillies related to talk about. Just a regular old nothing. Yeah. So the Phillies are blowing it at the moment in a serious way. Just a real outpouring of shit in the bed. Happening in South Philly right now. They're what, down 9-0 to the Nationals as we record this on Wednesday evening.
I think so.
Solid, not quite double digits, but
9-0.
And it looked like nine runs on the board.
I think it's about to get worse.
So 9+ runs on the board, and everybody's favorite positive vibes candidate of 2019, Nick Pivetta, looks to be at the center of a lot of the hot garbage just flowing from the Nationals' bats and into the field of play this evening. What was your original take on Nick Pivetta this season? I think I blindly went with the crowd and was like, you guys think he'll be good? Cool. Let's do it. Let's bank on Pivetta.
I think I said
Pivetta.
That too, because literally everyone was saying it. I don't know. I've always felt like I've had to jump on board with Nick Pivetta. I mean, here's the thing. I support him and want him to break out, but I've always liked Zach Eflin better. And you can go back and find those receipts. I have said it.
Well, that's fair. I'm just sort of the mind that, like, look, now, I mean, it's been a couple of years now, and the pool used to be a little wider. We used to be dealing with more than just Zach Eflin, Vince Velasquez, and Nick Pivetta. There was
Ben Lively.
There was Jake Thompson. There was Adam Morgan was at one point considered a starter. Sir Anthony Dominguez, did he start out?
Yeah, he was a starter. He began as a starter.
Mm-hmm. Ranger Suarez. Who's the other lefty? There's another lefty. It doesn't matter. The point is this. My assumption was just that we could go through the cyclical trend of picking a young starting pitcher who's definitely going to be the guy this year. We can keep doing that at the same time. The odds that one of these guys, one of them has to break out, right? Like that's this group is big enough. One of these guys has to emerge as serviceable. One of these guys has to emerge as a number five starter if you want. And what's foolish of me is to think that ever, because there is no amount of players who can't all suck. If you just look at a group of players in baseball, you can miss out. You can go over 10 so easily. Look at Chris Davis. I mean, I don't know why my hope was there, and I don't know. I wouldn't say it was gone at this point. We are what, 11 games into the season. So sure, it's ridiculous to freak out about anything, but it's fun to freak out a little bit. And I will use my little bit of freaking out to say, come on, one of those guys who has been inhabiting the last three spots in the Phillies rotation the past few years, one of them has to have some sustained success that lasts for most of a season. And I'm thinking now, like, one of them has, right? One of those guys, not Aaron Nola, obviously, but like one of them has had like a solid year, right? I was going to say Zach Eflin threw two complete games when he was a rookie.
Yeah, he did. He was good. There's a reason why I loved him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would love for people out there, all of you people listening, do not be this type of fan.
That we are being someone, right now?
Is that no, what you're saying? No.
I think that's good advice. Don't be like me.
The type of fan I'm about to describe. When someone has an opinion about a game, when there haven't been a lot of games played, or an opinion about a trend, don't be the person that jumps in and says, hey, small sample size. Nyeh. Do not be that person. I beg you. Because most of the time, the people saying it know that it's a small sample size. It's the 11th game of the season. Everyone knows. Don't be that fan. We don't need to know you're smart. You can just know.
I feel like there's maybe 1 month out of the baseball season where we don't have to make any sort of preemptive comment about fan reactions, because I think people act the same way at every course of the year, every year, and people react to them every year.
Find, like, when it stops being small sample size, they find a new thing to bitch about, and then they do that for a month, and then it moves down the line, and the cycle continues. Do not be that fan. Well, I don't want to judge fandom, but this is not about fandom. This is about just being an annoying human.
Look, Liz, sometimes that 1 hour on a podcast, that can be difficult to fill. So instead of instead of real things to discuss, you just fill it with utter nonsense. And that's what a lot of that's where I think a lot of those fans exist. You might even say,
in the time that we've been talking, the Nationals have scored 2 more runs.
That's terrific. That's really good. That's good for them. You know, they have a lot of fun young players. I've always admired the Nationals. At no point did I view them as filth in the dirt, able only to lick the sole of my boot. At no point did I compose a piece of writing with that phrase in it. I certainly didn't write it by candlelight with a quill and ink. I mean, you're describing the actions of an insane person. So I think it's perfectly on brand for the Nationals to be utterly pounding mercilessly the life out of the Phillies as we speak. So
it was going to happen.
Yeah.
It was going to happen. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. There's Jesus. Who is this person?
I'm going to go ahead and call this one a total wash and use that off.
I'm looking at the game day and I guess I'm sure Jose Alvarez is a person on the Phillies.
He sure is. He's the one who gave up 4 earned runs last night.
Oh, that's why. Yeah, that's why his ERA is the way it is.
It sure is. And speaking of which, Liz, taking a quick look at the numbers per our discussion, Zach Eflin's 25 years old. He's made 2 starts this season, and he's gone an average of at least 6 innings in both of them, which is a fancy way of saying he's pitched 12 innings this season. I don't want to say small sample size to myself, because you just said to not do that, but he's got the highest strikeout to walk ratio in the league with 14.
Really?
Yeah, with 14. Mm-hmm. At the same time, and I know this has been muttered while everyone considered Pivetta to be the sexy breakout pick, there's a chance that Zach Eflin is, in the background, creeping his way towards a similar goal. That's perfectly feasible.
Oh, there it is. His strikeout to walk ratio is so high because he's walked one player. He's walked one batter. Mm-hmm. That is, I'm wondering if it's all going to come back in one start.
Yeah, probably. I mean, that's what the Phillies.
Like, he's going to walk like 10 dudes in a game. I'd like to see that.
Yeah. The Phillies didn't commit an error until what, like seven games into the season? And then they committed three. Sometimes
these Phillies don't know how to do anything middle ground, man. It's fun. Like, it's painful at times, as we're seeing and learning, but it's fun because it's either the pedal is on the floor and they're scoring 10, 12 runs and everyone's hitting monster home runs, you know, with these juiced balls that are allowing ridiculous home runs before the weather's even warm. Or they're just, no one's hitting and the pitching is bad. And maybe they come back, but it's either everything.
But I don't want to watch that team honestly, I don't want to watch that team. I just want a team that's reasonably good the entire year with things I can rely on and things I can expect to happen. I mean, I don't want to predict the baseball game in full, but I don't want a team with an off switch again. I just it's unwatchable.
2011 is the only season in my memory that was like that, where it was automatic. 2010 was a roller coaster. Where 2009 is going to be a roller coaster.
I don't think so, Liz. I think these were all very relaxing, dominant performances. At no point did people devour their fingernails or drove their friends and loved ones crazy with the intensity with which they approached watching Philadelphia Phillies baseball games. I feel like these were all very relaxed, normal times for all of us in our personal lives.
This is what baseball is, unless your team is like the Red Sox last year were one of those teams, and their fans still found things to bitch about, which is exactly what will happen.
I literally just did it.
I was just gonna say it's happening right this moment. You know, this is what baseball is, and having just remembering vividly what we've gone through in the last, you know, seven years. I welcome this. Like, yeah, there's going to be some bad, but at least we know there's going to be some good. When the legitimately good players on the Phillies are going to be good. We don't have to hope they're going to make a leap and they're going to learn something or, you know, become the player we hope they are. We know who most of these players are, and eventually they're all going to be those guys at once. And so I can at least relax a little bit during what is going to end up being a righteous pounding. Oh my God.
Liz, this loss tonight, this is a very bad loss to a team you'd really love to lose, or the team you'd really love to beat every time you face them. A team that's probably going to be a pain in the ass with the Phillies all season long, which is probably going to be really fun and also kind of excruciating at times. Does this loss, and I don't want to let you wriggle away from this question because you may say this was bound to happen, but at the same time, you also walked away from watching this game and stopped watching it. So how much does this loss bum you out about the Phillies as a whole?
As you've said that, game day switched on. The bases are now loaded with one out.
MLB sent me an alert that said, you're probably going to want to stop watching this game.
I was right to turn it off. In our Slack, which, by the way, before we move off of this topic, I do want to report one other thing that was said, but I could do that in a minute. In the Slack tonight, I typed out and I didn't send, you know, our friend David Cohen is at the game. He said, this is the first time I've ever thought about leaving a baseball game before 9. And I typed out to him, we've watched so much shitty baseball in the last few years. Why would you purposely make yourself watch more? When you know this team is capable of more and will give you more, why are you going to make yourself watch something you know is going to be bad?
At the same time, like you just said, we sat through so much bad baseball. How is this worse, like at least in the context,
it's not,
you know?
But now the team is better and I'm smarter because Here's the thing, I watched it because there was maybe a chance that the Phillies might do better. I'm not gonna watch this game because I know they will do better another day.
I mean, they deserve that much, at least at this point, I would say.
It's not like I'm never gonna watch them again, and honestly it doesn't it's bad. It does, you know, it bums me out a little bit because obviously the Phillies are going to have to figure something out to stop the bleeding here. But I feel like they will, you know. John Middleton didn't invest all that money and prospects into this team to have this happen for too much longer.
Well, the thing about bleeding is that eventually everybody stops.
It stops because you attach a tourniquet or you die.
So that's where the Phillies are at in 2019. Yeah, you know, I got to say it has been less than 2 weeks. Nobody likes watching their team lose by multiple touchdowns. So
Phillies haven't even scored. Phillies have 3 hits.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for further details to illustrate my point.
I'm sorry. I'm just like, I'm not watching it. I'm just like really happy I'm not, but I'm looking at, I'm just like, oh no.
It does sort of feel like we've escaped from something.
I know. I'm watching game day and like, I could be like, this game is happening, but it's more fun watching just like the little, the pitches come across.
Well, the one thing that it's going on in Philadelphia right now is certainly a loss. But tonight we're going to talk about something in regards to the 2009 Phillies that occurred around this time that season. And that is the passing of Harry Callis. And I think I think everybody's obviously pretty familiar with that happening in 2009. I can remember where I was. I believe I was working in the equipment rental lab in Annenberg Hall at Temple University. We didn't want to just do a straight sort of remembrance of Harry Callis. I think we all know, we've all read the book about him. We're all, very familiar with Harry Callis's biography. So we don't want to just do a rundown of that. So instead, I just want to talk about a couple of things in regards to Harry that are interesting. But also, first, I want to just talk about, I guess, I don't want to say his legacy, because I don't really want to talk about his legacy. They've got a little plaque outside the broadcast booth now. I think it's literally called the Harry Callis Broadcast Booth or something. The people who sit in there now are obviously not as well favored as Harry Callis was. It'd be difficult to find anyone living in Philadelphia who would ever be as well revered as Harry Callis was in this city. So
I think the time for those types of figures is past, really.
Well, yeah, that's kind of what I want to get into. That the broadcasting industry is now without guys like Harry. I would say there's no Ernie Harwell, Harry Carey, Vin Scully. That sort of line of broadcasters who are considered sort of icons, just parts of baseball, not broadcasters even. That's gone. There's a lot more Tom McCarthy's and Ben Davis's out there. Even Hawk Harrelson retired in Chicago, didn't he?
Yeah, if not fully, then partially. I know he was, around for a while doing part time stuff. I try not to pay attention.
Yeah. That was not an advocation of.
No. I just realized that, like, every time I see his name, I just scroll right past immediately.
Well, I bring that up because, yeah, it does. It feels less of a personal industry, baseball broadcasting at this point. And I don't know, right now, Liz, currently the Phillies have far less popular broadcasters in the booth. If they felt like improvements were needed in that department, the team did. Obviously, a lot of fans do. A lot of fans have a lot of opinions about a lot of things. I'm sure you and I know you and I have our own opinions about Tom McCarthy, Ben Davis, Mike Schmidt, John Kruk, everything that's happening in the Phillies TV booth right now. If the team felt like improvements were needed, this season probably would have been the time to do it. A whole new generation of Phillies fans or people who weren't listening are now listening. You could make the argument pretty easily that the next Harry, if there would ever be one, hasn't arrived. So it begs the question to me, Liz, do you think that should have happened? Do you think they should have replaced the guys in the booth to usher in this new era of Phillies baseball?
Who do you replace them with?
Yeah.
I mean, whoever it is that the time to do it was a few years ago. The time to do it was when someone could really take the time and learn how to be a broadcaster, in this specific way with this team, with this type of crowd, that was the time. And they didn't do it. I think as much as we all bitch about the TV booth, I think, why spend more time on it? You're never going to make everybody happy. And I do think the time of those sort of indelible voices is gone. I think it was gone when Vin Scully retired.
What why though? Like, why can't there be a new version of that somewhere?
Because I think it's about the source, the amount of information that people get, the different style of broadcasting. Like, you know, instead of finding a really educated voice, instead of saying, let's put Jason Benetti in the main booth, they continue to be very deferential to the people they have in there. And then ESPN or whoever it is does that, you know, that StatCast broadcast, which poor Jason Benetti is stuck on, along with two complete dinguses. And I'll stand by that.
Jason and the Dinguses, 7 o'clock on MLB Network.
And it, like, that's what they, a good broadcaster is, a lot of it's about timing and knowing when to shut up. I don't think people know when to shut up. And I'm not saying that anybody needs to do anything differently. I'm just saying that it's a different style of broadcasting that seems to be kind of gone. You know, I don't know if we're going to get another indelible voice. I mean, part of it is the ubiquity. Like, I read most of the Harry the K biography, which I suggest everyone borrow and read and absorb it and then just never read it again, if only because, man, it's written like a third grade book report.
I think one reason we could point to as to why someone else with a classic storytelling style, the knowledge of when to let baseball tell its own story, and just like wonderful dulcet tones. I think part of the reason why that person we aren't aware of them is because one of the things Harry did for his voice was 2 packs of Parliament cigarettes a day for 60 years.
That and lots of, alcohol
and like
some hard living
that, people are smoking less. I guess they're vaping more, but I don't want to hear what Harry Callis, but if he'd been vaping for 60 years instead of smoking, sounds like. I don't want to meet that person. I actually think that they suck.
In a, you know, theoretically in a parallel universe, they do exist and they probably do suck. My favorite thing, reading the book, there's a whole chapter about everything that Harry did outside of the Phillies. He was a workaholic. You know, he really worked a lot. He did commercials. He was the voice of NFL films. Right before he died, he did a Super Pretzel commercial, which just like, let's have all the things that I love together. But you know who Frank Welker is?
Yeah.
Frank Welker, for anybody you might not know, he has like 800, I looked it up a few days ago for a completely different thing. He has like 835 credits on his IMDb. He's a voice actor. You'll probably know him as Fred from Scooby-Doo. He's been Fred pretty almost every iteration of Fred and Scooby-Doo, but he also provides animal voices, animal sounds, and ambient noises. The man has got to have like a golden toilet. He's done everything. And I feel like Harry Callis is that, but broadcasting for just like a time before, because he did like Campbell's Soup. You know, Greg Dobbs, when he came to the Phillies, he heard Harry in the hallway and he's like, what is the guy from NFL films doing here? And he's our broadcaster. I'm just like, he must have thought, wow, the Phillies must be heaven, because like later he won a World Series there. Like then he retired and went away. Like how's that? The guy from NFL films called his, you know, this part-time players World Series ring.
And you might think the same thing about Tom McCarthy if you ever have watched the ninth tier sub marquee NFL football game on a Sunday, the Jaguars Chargers game. If you were watching that, you probably heard Tom McCarthy, which I talk about us having opinions about the current booth. I'm just kind of used to them at this point. Like I think I had the same viewing experience as anyone listening and to Tom McCarthy. I felt like he's a professional broadcaster, but it doesn't really feel like, you know, it doesn't feel like he's there with the Phillies. It feels like he's there for his job. I don't know. That's how I used to describe it. At this point, like I said, I'm more used to it. And like you said, I can't imagine something being worse, but I can imagine something being different, being perceived as worse, just because it's a thankless job. And it's made even more thankless by the fact that he had to fill the shoes of somebody like Harry Callis, who is four universally revered figures in Philadelphia who, like, no one would ever say that they suck. That's impossible for him to do. So, he is
who he is. Yeah,
exactly. And he seems like a perfectly nice and wonderful guy too. So, yeah. You know, Greg Murphy once told me that, he said something about how, he doesn't, or when and where you choose to interact with people who bitch at you on Twitter. And, he's like, I do, you know, I tend to approach it like this. And I said, Tom seems to be pretty active. I don't, and he's like, yeah, he's like, that's probably too active is what I tell him.
Amazing. Yep. I mean, like I said, they are, you know, they are who they are. And I don't, it's not my cup of tea, but I don't think they're bad. You know, like, they're not any worse than any other booth, really. They're not, like, they're better than a number of booths. Like, I would listen to, you know, John Crux sleepily, you know, wake himself up from his mid-inning nap, you know, or Ben Davis talk about whatever the, you know, whatever traditional baseball thing he's spouting off today. I would rather listen to that than FP Santangelo.
Oh, God.
I'd rather listen to them than the Braves booth.
Oh, yeah. I've turned off games because I realized that the Braves booth was my only option. That's true. Mm-hmm. The Mets booth is delightful.
The Mets booth is, like, there are some problems that, you know, Ron Darling and Keith Hernandez aren't the most forward-thinking gentlemen at all. But they have a really great rapport. They managed to make a three-man booth work, which I really don't – I think that's too many people. I've always thought that's too many. I also think that Ron Darling and Keith Hernandez sound very similar. I've listened to them for years, and I continue to have a tough time telling them apart.
Honestly, a three-man booth is an amazing concept when you consider we're talking about Harry Callis, a guy who was in a two-man booth that for maybe a half inning at a time would say nothing. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow they can find room for three guys in there in a time where I think most broadcasters are covering silence rather than letting it play out.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, yes, there are better and worse options out there. But the fact of the matter is, if this team becomes really good, nobody's going to be talking about the booth. And it's something that has come up in the past few years because the team has been so bad. And people probably got more agitated with them for that reason. When you're watching a shitty team, you're going to get mad at the way that shitty team is being explained to you, regardless of who's doing it. You know, I mean, again, yeah. This is something Harry Callis transcended, having been the broadcaster for many, many generations of terrible Phillies teams. But
I mean, I give Scott Fransky a lot of credit. He's not quite as warm as Harry was, you know, as far as his relationship with the audience. But he's very wry and funny. He's very dry, and he, you know, you could kind of tell, as bad as the baseball was, it kind of, it gives the broadcaster a chance to sort of spread their wings and figure out how far they can go. So I respected that about Scott Fransky. He found ways to make it fun, even when Larry Anderson was just pitching some kind of fit next to him.
But their rapport was obviously a big part of their appeal, and Scott Fransky's appeal. You know, a couple of years ago, well, probably 10 years ago at this point, that was obviously a big part of Fransky's appeal. And I don't mean that like he's not singularly appealing, because he is, but it's more, it's just like that's why people were tuning in, and that's like a gift. And Chris Wheeler was talking about that in one of the video tributes to Harry Callis, that when you're in the booth with somebody who it's not working with, it's the most difficult and trying job in the world. And that's why, like, seeing two guys like Harry Callis and Richie Ashburn come together, or 10 years ago Fransky and LA get to sit in the booth together, that seems very uncommon. They're always going to have somebody in that other chair, and they may not care whether or not you get along with them too well. So, that's obviously a big part of that. And I've noticed that I think some of the things that we used to like just mention to each other were happening on the radio broadcast because they were funny are now repeated like as if they're bad things. So it's also just part of it is at least Larry Anderson has been undeniably grumpy for the past couple of years and has even yeah. begun to limit his travel and broadcasting with the team. But at the same time, we all did age 10 years and maybe we just don't find some of the shtick we thought was funny 10 years ago funny anymore.
That's entirely possible. Larry's trying, he's apparently making an effort this year to be a little less grumpy, which is good. I think that's a great thing. I don't know if it'll work. But they've also cut down on his, I think more of his broadcast time, which, he's older. I think he's moving towards retirement. Let's not get in his way. I was just wondering to myself, last year it was the carousel of Kevins with Scott Fransky, Kevin Stocker, Kevin Jordan,
those two, yeah. Stocker, Franson, and Jordan. I thought you said Franson.
Yes. I don't know if I said it
in my head. But why do I have your voice in my We might be podcasting too much. Anyway, please.
We might be. But Fransky, I remember listening to Kevin Stocker was at least excitable. He was not great, but he was excitable and I could at least listen to him. Kevin Jordan had the personality of a rock, and listening to Scott Fransky try to get through a broadcast with him, especially in the early going, it was painful.
Yeah.
It was hard to listen to. And I wonder how much of his opinion they took into account when making the decision this year, because it sounded like he and Fransky had been broadcasting forever. It was easy because Fransky just talks to himself.
Yeah,
he does. It's a Larry Anderson style because he'll be watching and he'll make a comment without Scott saying anything, which you kind of need. You need a back and forth. Kevin Jordan, I feel like, was just sort of sitting watching the game motionless.
Yeah, he was. I think the right decision was made. And I think Kevin Franson probably knew like halfway, if not sooner through the season, that he was getting that job if he had heard the other two guys. It was, nothing against him personally, but there was a clear winner there. This team needed some enthusiasm, and that was the change they made for this season that I think did make a lot of sense from a broadcasting perspective. That that was definitely a good move. I look forward to hearing him again. I was just thinking like, oh right, this is a homestand, so he's not in the booth. I think that's it, right? That
He went also. Larry went to the opening series, I believe, or wherever it is they were. He went for the two game series in Washington. He went with them, and Franson didn't do it. So,
well, one thing that I do want to say about Scott Fransky is that as popular as he is, he should be even more popular because one thing that happened that nobody talks about is that Fransky, do you remember that time they went to commercial in one of those terrible years and he had a hot mic and Scott Hairston had just hit a home run for the Mets and the mic caught him saying, how can they I'm paraphrasing, but it was very similarly profane. It's like, how can they fucking give up a home run to Scott Hairston? He stinks. That's great. He's right. He's just perfectly embodying what the fans were thinking. He cursed on the radio. I mean, why is he not the most beloved?
Well, because I just looked it up. It was 2012, which it should be more popular because people were still nominally paying attention, but you could that was born of the Phillies are supposed to be a lot fucking better than this. Why are they so bad? They won 102 games a year ago. They should not be giving up this bullshit to Scott Hairston.
Where is he? The actual quote was, somebody figure out how to fucking get Scott Hairston out. He stinks. Jesus Christ.
After saying how to fucking get him out, he's like, which he stinks.
He's like, yeah, has a rooted investment in the team. He's
Which is what you want.
That's something else I wanted to talk about because Harry Callis and Richie Ashburn were very much Phillies fans. And you can see that in Fransky and Larry Anderson in the same way, how LA will root openly, you know, root and clap for the Phillies during the broadcast. I feel like there's a line there. It depends on your personality, depends on the like reputation you have or the reputation you build. So it has something to do with who you are as a broadcaster. Because I've seen people complain that the broadcast was being too homery. And I've also seen people complain that they don't seem like I just did, like they don't seem, you know, personable or for the Phillies. So, I mean, I'm of the mind that obviously the broadcaster needs to be a fan. And I think every broadcast is, you know, when you watch those must see clips on MLB.com and they show all three broadcasts, the home team's TV booth, radio booth, and then the away team's or the, you know, losing team's booth. And when they do the losing team's booth, there's always like a, you know, much more neutrally announced thing that happened. So I think that is an industry standard. But like how much is there too much fandom that a broadcaster can show during a game? Does that matter to you? Because I don't know if I want a full on cheerleader, but I do want, you know, somebody who's excited that they're winning.
I agree. Exactly. There's a line, like you're not supposed to don't openly crap on the other team.
I'm okay with that.
That's too homery.
Okay with that.
Mm-hmm. Listen, I would love it if they did it every now and then, but I think as far as if we're looking at broadcasting rules, I feel like that is the line that you can't cross. You know, you can't like openly cheering during at bats, but you know, I feel like Harry Callis's calls in that golden era, like when he called Mike Schmidt's 500th home run, which I listened to mere moments before going on the air. I think it was made better because the two of them had a personal relationship outside of the game. And that's part of Harry's, it's the legend of him, you know, sitting in the back of the plane and being accepted by this group of, you know, by these players in, you know, in that period and through, you know, 93 and beyond. I think that just creates a special way of broadcasting, you know, and I don't know if that's, you know, I don't think we could get that from anybody, maybe ever again, just because the world and baseball isn't that way anymore. But if you can't have that, you want to at least have a broadcaster who gives a shit about the team that they're calling, because when you call them every night, I can't believe that you're going to, you know, when you work there, when you're with these people, you travel with them, you see them all the time. I believe that even if it's not that Harry Callis relationship, that is going to build something. And I'm glad that Scott Fransky has sort of let it build somewhat. So his calls have emotion. He cares. Like you want that. It's not about being a homer. It's just about caring about the team that you're watching. And the words that you're saying to the people who are also presumably fans and who care deeply.
I can't imagine how just mind-draggingly inane it is to be someone whose job is to watch and narrate the kind of baseball that these Phillies have been playing the past few years. And that's just the past few years. Harry Callis and Richie Ashburn, like I said, they had way, way more time to talk about way, way more shitty Phillies teams. And through all of that, which, you know, whenever you jump on board as a Phillies fan, you will undergo, you know, a couple seasons of unwatchable crap. I mean, every team does, but it just historically you look back on the Phillies and there's been a lot of those seasons. And I had to, you know, I got introduced to the Phillies with the 1993 team. I had to learn after that season that you don't always have the like scrappiest, most fun, coolest team in baseball every year. Actually, most of the time it's the opposite. And that was something you just had to, you know, educate yourself as a fan. But through all of that, all that shit we call Phillies fandom, there was one continuous anchor, and that was, well, at least we have Harry. And I mean, you didn't even think about it that much because he was just such a fixture that like you turn on the Phillies game and there's Harry. it's not that you didn't appreciate it. It's just like, yeah, that was part of the Phillies. Yeah, it was a luxury that we got to have. But you know, I for a while, I honestly thought out of here was just how people, that's just how home runs were described. I just thought that was a universal term. I didn't realize that was like his thing that he said. So, you know, we kind of talked about, Liz, that if the Phillies were going to make a change in the current booth, they probably, you know, now would have been a good time for it because of this new generation of Phillies fans that are obviously watching the team now. They didn't. We've come to terms with that now. I mean, we have, yeah, and it's fine. But what does hearing the same voice for decades, or just at least for a while, I mean, what do you think that does for a team's ability to instill itself on a new generation of fans? Just having like that, like an anchor, like there to be like, all right, yeah, a lot of stuff's going to be evolving and changing over the years, but the people telling you about it, it's good, you know, they'll be the same.
I don't think you necessarily realize what you have until it's gone, because it's not like anyone takes it for granted, but you know, that is the way it is. Harry calls games. You know, you don't realize what an integral part it is, you know, to you until it's not there. And when it's not there anymore, it's all nostalgia. It's all nostalgia and memories. And, you know, that anchor is important because you look back and you realize, oh, this was the voice that I heard all the time through my childhood, through my adolescence, through college. This was the voice that was there. But when it's part of your daily life, you don't necessarily realize it, you know? I don't think if I asked my, you know, in the 90s, if I'd asked my dad about Harry Callis, you know, maybe he would have said something, but he still was able to listen to him every now and then, call games, even though he wasn't living in Philadelphia. You know, asking him about it now, when there's no, you know, there are clips of him online, but you can't just turn on a game at night and listen to him. You know, my dad has a lot more to say. And a lot more memories to share, and a lot more, you know, sadness and bittersweet memories and, you know, thoughts about how Harry's voice filled up, you know, a whole part of his life.
Yeah. And I'm wondering now at this point that if there aren't some young fans for whom the current Phillies TV booth will just, you know, they will just fill that role, that they just feel like, okay, I learned later that, you know, they weren't universally beloved, but at the same time, that was in the same way that people treat the version of baseball they watched when they were a kid as baseball at its best, they probably consider the announcers similarly. If just because of nostalgia that, you know, these are the guys that told me what was happening in baseball games when I was at my youngest and purest, and yeah, that's that holds a special place. In the same way that people, like, you watch an old video clip on YouTube and hear like the Prism introduction and you're like, ah, oh, that's so mm-hmm. nice, when it was like created by a, you know, one guy in a closet on a computer the size of a washing machine, like so
wow, fancy for that time.
Washing, yes, slick size. Yeah, that's wow. Travel, that's for commuters. but yeah, I mean, I think that does a lot. And just, it's weird to think that we considered Harry Callis just like normal, that it was just, that is our normal, like you said, with Greg Dobbs. It's just, it's surreal that was the case. But yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about Harry Callis and broadcasting when we get back from this break. So Liz, as we're talking about Harry Callis, and we're close to the anniversary of his death, which was on April 13th, 2009 in Washington. He collapsed in the broadcast booth in Washington at the stadium, and passed away back in 2009. And it would have been crazy for us to talk about this season without mentioning the tragedy that was losing Harry Callis. So it's crazy to consider when you're looking back on like this era of Phillies history. We've all seen the clip of Harry and Chris Wheeler in the booth at the end of the 2008 World Series, and you kind of forget that his story, you know, just kind of it ends not too long after that. And you know, that's covered in great deal in the book that came out, Harry the K, by Randy Miller. And I know you were looking at that this week. And yeah, I mean, I didn't get a chance to open it and look at it again. I think it's one of the books I still have. I went through a baseball book purge not too long ago. I don't know if you ever have to get yourself to do that. I think not. You're a hoarder, aren't you?
When it comes to books, I guess it depends on what they are. I went through a cookbook purge recently because I have a lot of them. But I actually decided to get like a separate tall, skinny bookcase for my baseball books. And I have a lot of room left.
I'm going to like...
Actually, that's a lie. I don't have a lot of room left. It's almost full already. I don't want to... I don't get rid of books a lot. Though my fiance and I are planning on moving sometime in the next like 18 months. So... I might have some books to give away at some point. Check Twitter and like,
I'm
going to
like be in your house looking at your bookshelf and see a bunch of books that I threw away, now on your shelf.
You and I are just going to trade baseball books.
Do you like how I made that seem like it was going to be a question about Harry Callis? And then I accused you of being a hoarder. I feel like I really turned that around on you.
Listen, like I said, I will freely admit I hoard craft supplies and books. You know, I think there are worse things to hoard because I might, maybe someday I'll finish a bunch of those craft projects. And I've read most of the books that I have. So,
all right. Well, it's not fun when you just admit it like that. That's not.
Fuck you. There
all
you
right.
Go.
But in reading this book, I mean, in revisiting the pretty well-known biography of Harry Callis, Did anything jump out at you that you feel like you didn't know or forgot in the time since you last read it?
Well, I mean, about his death, which I haven't gotten to the whole section that's about his death. I've made it up through sort of through the chapter where they talk about the fight between Harry and Wills, which appeals to have been manufactured mostly by a third party. But I didn't know that Larry Anderson did CPR on him.
Oh, I didn't know
that
either. Wow.
That's a heavy thought. That's a heavy thought. I said to you a little earlier, he seems like a cartoon dad. He seems like, you know, like a mix between John Belushi and Animal House and Ward Cleaver. I feel like, and add like a Harry Callis, the broadcaster, just the voice, shove that in there. And that's what you've got. Because, you know, he was a complicated guy. And I appreciate knowing about, you know, the people that I like knowing that they're real people. He's not just a cardboard cutout with a voice. You know, he had faults. He did not great things. The one thing that I got from the book is that he was a good guy who was very generous with very generous with his time, who never took his fame, you know, such as it was, for granted. You know, he would always stop and tell a story. He would always stop and shake a hand. He didn't like the word fans. He didn't like that. He liked to call fans my friends, which I thought was very striking.
You know, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but my grandparents took my cousin and I down for spring training in Clearwater, and it was just another banner year of the Phillies. Another terrific roster of memorable names like Alex Arias and Steve Schrenk. That was one of them. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, you had some Mike Lieberthal in there, and you had, I think, you know, 12-year-old Pat Burrell somewhere in the outfield. But, largely it was – I got a lot of autographs that spring from guys I do not know. But one autograph that two autographs I did get. I was young at the time. I think I was old enough to be in the front of an awkward phase, but still young. And my grandfather and my cousin and I were at a game in Clearwater. And after the game, my grandpa just kind of decided, he was a pretty direct, polite guy. And he was like, well, you know, we should go up here and poke our heads into the booth and say hi to Harry. And I was just like, what? He's like, he was talking about him like he was his friend, like he was Harry Callis' friend.
I'm going to poke my head. I didn't see how my friends are doing today.
Yeah. And he wasn't. Like, he did not know Harry personally. I feel like maybe they interacted a time or two at events or whatever, but Harry Callis would not have, I don't think, known my grandfather. But for when I was a kid, the way my grandparents talked about Harry Callis, the way Harry Callis kind of like reminded me of my grandfather, I kind of just assumed that they were friends for a while when I was very young. It's like, oh, grandpa's friend is on the
That's so cute.
I was also the child that believed my dad left for a softball game once, and then when they turned a Phillies game on, one of the players waved at the TV, and I was convinced it was my father waving at me from the softball game.
That's really cute. Oh, so Justin.
My grasp on reality was tenuous at best. The point being that my grandfather, he turns around, he walks up the bleachers, and just like he didn't go into the booth, but the window was open of the booth. And he stuck his head and he's like, hey, Harry, you know, I've got my two grandsons down here and they just want to like, they want to say hi to you or can they get like an autograph? And they were like, yeah, sure. And Harry was in there with Larry Anderson. And yeah, you know, I just popped my head up and yeah, like I said, beginning of an awkward phase. Mm-hmm. It's not the best face you want popping up and like being at close range from you twice.
Broadcaster in the 70s, he's seen worse.
but I remember so distinctly just handing him my baseball with the Phillies logo on it, and he took it and he looked up and winked at me after he signed it, and he was just gave me a wink, gave me the ball back, and he was like, yeah, you know, thanks so much, it's great to meet you. And Larry Anderson did pretty much the same thing, and then he shook my grandpa's hand. My grandpa was like, thanks so much, that was great. And he was like no problem, and we just kind of went on our way, having said hello to my grandfather's best friend in all the world, Harry Callis. And I say I remember it so distinctly, but I also feel like I don't think about it a whole lot. Like, I almost forget that it happened, that I had this very brief, unmemorable to him, personal exchange with Harry Callis. And you know, when you're that far away from somebody, you kind of build your opinion of them based on moments like either like that or based on what they allow to be out in public about them. And Harry Callis just always seemed to, like you said, complicated guy. He had his flaws, definitely. But every story like that about Harry Callis is about how wonderful he is. And, yeah. You know, one thing you learn as you get older is that is so, so uncommon.
Yeah. He, like, the wink, just the extra second to give you a wink to let you know, like, that's a conscious act. That's what it is. Because, you know, taking a baseball and signing it is something that he's done a lot. You know, the baseball players do a lot. But, like, looking at a kid and giving a wink is a conscious act that shows I'm actively participating in this with you right now, which seems to be like the hallmark of, you know, the many interactions, you know, with fans and you know, colleagues that Randy Miller talks about in the book. Like, you know, Bob Costas has words to say about Harry Callis. You know, some of the most, you know, well-respected men in sports. And it's weird to think that our broadcaster for so many years was so well thought of, because a lot of these guys are just regional figures. But, like, Harry was known around the country. I mean, for different things. Like, in Philly, he was the baseball guy. But everywhere else, he was NFL Films, Campbell's Soup, you know, Electric Company, the other 8 million things that he did.
One of the features the Inquirer ran after the day after Harry died was a story where they just let their four baseball writers or columnists just write about their stories about Harry Callis. And they all had multiple stories, and they were all different from each other, and they were all personal in these, you know, in these really personal ways. And in fact, it was they took something, part of something Jason Stark wrote on ESPN.com, because he's obviously came from the Inquirer. And he actually wrote, how do we fill the unfillable void that will hang over us forever now as we try to contemplate life and baseball without Harry Callis? Can't be done, can it? And to circle back, that's the job Tom McCarthy got.
I mean, there's no way to fill it. That's why I said, like, this, the time in baseball in the 70s, in that the 70s and the 80s and the early 90s, it's a different world. It's like an alien world compared to what baseball is now. Baseball back then was, you know, people, you know, the Wild West of baseball, everyone says, was long, long ago, but it was a different type of Wild West. at that point. There were a lot less rules. Things were a lot less corporate. And that's why, like, a guy like Harry could go be in the back of the plane. He could be this Harry. Like, there's just, this time is kind of gone. You know, there's no, it's, a franchise is lucky if they have an indelible voice. If they have a voice that will always be associated with them and that will always be remembered. Like, people spent like years commemorating Vince Scully before he had even retired, because I think so many people were afraid he was going to just die.
Every year felt like his last year, the way people talked about him.
Yeah.
Every year.
Because people, I think people saw the way a guy like Harry died in the booth. And they wanted to appreciate him while he was still doing it, which, you know, as annoying as it got near the end, and I love Vince Scully, but, you know, I could never get too angry at it, because I'm like, this is a chance we never got with Harry. You know, thank, you know, the powers that be that he got to call a World Series. He got to call a World Series win. And then he died. Like, it really is kind of, I mean, I don't, if you brought him back from the dead and asked him how he'd want to go out, could you pick a better way? Like, he called a World Series, got a whole off season of amazing, you know, accolades and wonderfulness, called a few games in the 2009 season, and then
I would
died
say he would
doing
pick either
that
or a tiki bar in Hawaii. You know, we're talking about indelible voices here. Somebody I did not mention in that group initially, who I believe might still be active. He might be retired. Who we just talked about on Hitting Season is Bob Uecker in Milwaukee, who is just absolutely magnificent. And you want to talk about treasures? Good Lord! And that he, what he does is, you know, it also I think, unrepeatable by someone else. Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, and did he also manage to step into the acting world somehow?
Seamlessly.
He'll be commemorated in Major League till the heat death of the universe. You know, until the earth no longer exists, people will show their kids and their friends Major League, and he'll be there. Like, that's awesome. But was it Mr. Belvedere or Alf? I always get it confused. He was Mr. Belvedere,
I think,
right?
It was Mr. Belvedere, yeah. Yeah, and the story that the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel ran about him prior to the regular season last year, if this was in March 2018, was just about how, like, how many times he'd almost died. And it's about half about half the article is about him getting bitten by a brown recluse.
Oh my God.
The life and times, man. But yeah.
I just looked up his Wikipedia page. He was, you know, he was a bad hitter for the for a number of teams, but he played for the Braves in 62. They have a picture of him. He has the same face. It's Tommy Joseph old man.
Ooh,
face.
Oh yeah, that's a good classification.
He had it back then. Like, it's just a face that is what it is. It never changes. He had it then, he'll have it forever. It's part of his charm. Like Harry Callis had that face. Like, looking at the pictures in that book, he looked pretty much the same from age 18 until when he
died. That's the dream. Well, those are the, I knew we would be talking about Harry Callis at some point this season. I always forget how early in the season that he passed away in 2009. But I'm glad.
It was a minute.
Yeah, I'm glad we got to talk about him at length on this episode of Continued Success. I just want to leave you with a brief list of adjectives that have been used to describe Harry Callis's voice, which is raspy, resonant, dulcet, mellow, baritone, golden, leathery, well-paced, measured, commanding, and a gift from God. I just don't know how you could ever replicate that, and you probably don't. You probably won't, and that's fine.
Yeah. I have one final thought. Every year, I think maybe I skipped last year, but every year on the anniversary of his death, I always listen to the WIP broadcast, which you can find on YouTube from the day he died, which features, I mean, it's like 15 minutes of your life that you'll spend feeling lots of ways, but it's, you know, Scott Fransky doing his best not to lose it not long after Harry Cowles died mere feet from him. And it's an extraordinary sort of tour de force from Scott Fransky, and listening to it always makes me feel like, you know, Harry was guiding him somehow in having to do this incredibly difficult job, you know? So spend some time, listen to that, and listen to some of his great calls, because, man, I'm glad that, you know, the internet exists and we can all listen to them, because in a different time, they'd be gone forever.
Listening to Harry Cowles call a play or a home run that you have very warm memories about is the closest thing we have to time traveling. So if you if you want to engage in something like that, tonight's the anniversary of his passing is that time. But in any case, next week we will be discussing the Phillies' second half of the month of April in 2009 and whatever else the current Philadelphia Phillies are up to. Hell, maybe this game will be over by then.
Maybe they won't be losing then. I haven't checked in on the game in a little while.
Maybe that sounds like a comeback.
No.
Well, before Liz explains what happened, we're gonna just talk to you next time on Continued Success. Don't forget to subscribe, download, and rate all the podcasts that are part of the Good Fight podcast family. That's Hittin' Season, Continued Success, and The Dirty Inning, of which there is a fresh new episode as well. So thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on Continued Success.